there's this sort of idea that climate change is somewhere in the distant future. The reality is that the economic imperative tends to win out. COP30, I think, is going to be a big reckoning moment.
Hello, everyone. Welcome to the Mobilize podcast. I'm David Lytle. Today, I'm going to be interviewing Kirsten Pearson, and we're going to be talking about money, specifically climate finance money, transition money, just transition, and everything to do with the climate and money. Let's jump straight into it.
Yes, thanks for having me on. This is exciting to be part of. I'm Kirsten Pearson. I'm a climate finance researcher, and I work at the South African Institute of International Affairs, SIAA. We're a think tank, and we've been going for 90 years, so it's been around for a long time, yes. And the think tank is this year the co-chair of the Think 20, which is an engagement group of the G20. And our work focuses on international affairs with a African lens, and we based here in South Africa.
Cool. Much. There's a whole bunch of different things I'm going to want to chat to you about today, and I actually pulled this up. I'd forgotten that you're part of the think tank trend. But my understanding as well is that you really have a climate finance focus with the work you do.
Yes, so that is my narrow, specific role in the work. And it's quite nice to have a focused role where you can deep dive into a specific area.
So I think let's maybe actually start by just for our audience who might not be familiar, do you want to quickly describe what is climate finance?
Sure. So I think of climate finance as the finance that makes climate actions possible. And usually the kind of buckets that people think about when looking at climate finance is finance for mitigation actions and then adaptation. And there's a new category that's been added, which is loss and damage. So there's this sort of idea that climate change is somewhere in the distant future. But really, people are feeling the effects of climate change now. So loss and damage also becomes part of that picture.
Yeah, that's I think a very important sort of caveat. I'm wondering about some of our audience, and a lot of Mobilize's videos have explained the difference between mitigation and adaptation. But do you want to give it a quick stab so that for anyone who hasn't heard about those sort of distinct parts of the climate conversation to understand what that is?
Yeah, sure. And I can zone in on it as it also affects developing countries versus developed.
Sure.
So mitigation actions are to address the existing emissions, and for developing countries which don't have that much fossil fuel emissions compared to the developed countries, mitigation is less of our work. We're more trying to adapt to the effects of climate change.
Okay.
And so a lot of the financing, and this is quite an important thing about the climate financing, isn't actually reaching the countries that need it, because 90% goes to mitigation.
And not adaptation.
Exactly.
And I think, so just also make it very clear, mitigation is stuff like turning off a coal power plant and switching over to solar or wind or something.
Yeah. So also maybe I can just add, having said that developing countries are not fossil fuel intensive, you know, in South Africa, we're quite committed to our coal, unfortunately. Yeah.
Well, I think it's fascinating, right? Because I think South Africa and India are good examples of this, is that we are both in a big part developing countries, but we also have these developed industrial cores, which are incredibly emitting. So it's kind of a weird thing where we're not quite what a developed nation is in terms of carbon intensity or the amount we pollute per person, but we're not the same as most of the countries to our north.
Yeah, and that's something that comes into the multilateral diplomacy around climate actions. And it's the idea that developing countries need a little bit of latitude. So for example, us in South Africa, we obviously want to do a transition to green energy and embrace renewables and so on. But if we transition too fast, we might be plunged into industrialization. into load shedding. Yeah.
Literally the opposite of industrialization.
Yes.
Yeah.
We have to, in terms of how the global expectations work, balance that up. Is that, you know, developing countries also want to industrialize, and they haven't done that to the extent of the developed countries on the basis of fossil fuels.
Yeah.
Yeah. So the hope is that, you know, we can have a more green circular economy, and that the industrialization can be on the basis of green development.
Yeah.
But we do have countries like South Africa, and you are mentioning India as well, that do have fossil fuels. And so there is an element of transition for us, and it is about weighing up how fast that happens.
I think I also really want to, you were saying about basically like, don't want to go into load shedding. And I think one of the ways we look at why climate change is a problem is climate change destroys our economy, like damages our economy. It makes us spend more on less things. It also kills people through the disasters, through the poverty it creates. But so does load shedding.
Oh, yes.
I think, you know, there's the obvious ways in terms of like, okay, there was an operation happening in the hospital and the power gets interrupted and the doctors get distracted and someone dies on the table. But poverty kills. And even we don't have load shedding, South Africa's energy shortage has actually been killing people in a sense, because it's perpetuated poverty in the country. So you were talking about this is what climate finance is for, but it's also that the finance we're talking about in South Africa, climate finance is also actually finance for energy. It's finance to build. It's not just to replace our coal, it's actually to build a larger grid, which can create more industrialization, create more jobs. How much do you sort of look at that, and how much is that part of the work you guys are doing at SIA?
What you can see playing out in diplomacy is this weighing up of energy security and climate actions. And so I've been having a look at the G20 leaders' declarations over time, and also the BRICS declarations, and having a look at which of these, if you can look at them weighing up against each other, energy security versus taking action for climate, to mitigate climate change,
Yeah. You
kind of see that energy security will win out. So maybe we'll commit to the Paris Agreement in the leaders' declaration. We'll commit to weaning ourselves off fossil fuel incentives and so on. But the reality is that the economic imperative tends to win out. And it is complex to deal with, because that, economic reality is people's livelihoods. Mm-hmm. And, you know, it's a difficult one. So it tends to be something that affects the ability globally to meet the goals that we've set to stay within 1.5 degrees temperature rise above pre-industrial levels. But we're not actually on that trajectory. We're going to overshoot it. And this is something that we're going to have to grapple with at COP30. So COP30, I think, is going to be a big reckoning moment where we go, we're actually not on track to meet the sustainable development goals. We're going to exceed the Paris Agreement. It's a little bit of a frustrating kind of dire moment. And for me, I'm quite interested in the role of climate finance in enabling us to reach those climate actions.
There's so many things I want to jump on there. And then
I could see you were very keen to jump in.
One is, I think, just to point out to listeners who may not be aware, is that last year the global average temperature was 1.5 degrees Celsius above pre-industrial.
Yeah, it's the first time that it's got to that level.
Now, there is a variation from year to year generally. And And what that means is that, you know, this year will probably be below that. We don't expect it to be every year. But at some point, that will become pretty much every year, the average. And, you know, we have evidence. I think people in their lived experiences have noticed, particularly people that do farming and sort of work in more rural environments where you don't have all the technology to offset the impact of climate. They've noticed that, right? The increased flood, the changing weather patterns. So you rely on rainfall and now it's a different time of year, or more or less. And actually, on that more or less, even when it's more, it's not always better because a whole bunch of crops require there to be a dry period. We've adapted to that. It actually brings things to the part we kind of did skip over, which is adaptation.
Yes.
So, and a tricky thing about adaptation is with mitigation, you're like, okay, well, I'll put money into building a solar power plant, which will sell electricity to people to give them money back. Whereas adaptation is basically reduction of harm. It's saying, okay, how do we intervene so that flooding doesn't happen in these Eastern Cape communities, which we
kind of build a flood wall.
Exactly, those sort of things. So I think.
Yeah, you're touching on a financial conundrum because, like you're saying, the mitigation actions attract revenue after you've invested in them a lot of the time. And the adaptation is more like a grudge purchase, but you have to do it and it doesn't really generate money. And so that makes it difficult to attract private financing. And because the level of public financing for climate action is not at the level that we need it to be at, there is this expectation that the private financing will come in and bulk up that amount of finance. And yeah, it's a difficult one to figure out for adaptation.
I think there's a point you made that it doesn't work. You know, if we're so 1.5 degrees Celsius, we are above pressure level. That is a policy failing. That is that we've known this is an issue for 30 years now, and we haven't acted, right? And granted, it's a big job to change the way our industries work and to change the way society works. But I'd say, generally speaking, our current economic system has not supported us dealing with climate change very well, albeit today we're doing a much better job than we were in the past because renewable energies have become so feasible. But even then, we're typically not turning off fossil fuels early. We're turning off when we would turn them off and just replacing them with renewables. It's generally the global pattern, with some exceptions, but not. Like with some wealthier countries are doing things differently. Wealthier countries that have a sense of responsibility or accountability, the way to say it. Because there is a certain very large country which doesn't have a sense of accountability for their energy mix. So what I'm guessing at is the model by which we have to make profit on the switch to renewables and really doesn't work very well in terms of adaptation. I mean, in terms of mitigation. In terms of adaptation, it just doesn't exist whatsoever.
Yes. So there has to be some kind of acknowledgement that the public finance, so for example, the tax revenue money that a country has to spend through its budget, some of that needs to be allocated to adaptation projects. And also there's a kind of moral and legal imperative for the developed countries to provide financing to the developing countries. So there's an extent of concessional finance such as grant funding, and that kind of money needs to be applied to adaptation because it's just really difficult to attract the private finance here.
Well, there's lots of answers, right? There's some like ideas about revolutionary system changes in terms of how economies are run. But if we were to say for a second, how is it possible within the current economic system, it's actually billing for the damage, right? It's saying that in South Africa, you have sort of Totals, Exxaro, various coal and oil and gas companies should actually pay an additional levy for the climate harm. And in some way, we actually need to do it in a historical sense as well, not just in a present day sense. So how do we account for the corporations that have been polluting the atmosphere for the last 150 years? And that's what you're talking about, the global north's responsibility, right? Because that's particularly where it becomes a thing of actually, I know restitution can be a difficult word for the global north to say, and they don't like it very much, but there is some, you've got a debt to pay. So we're happy to acknowledge all the, when I say we're happy, I mean like kind of the global economic system is very happy to acknowledge debt accrued by developing countries at really quite ridiculous interest rates at times compared to normal interest rates. But they're not willing to acknowledge the debt, even though it's real. It's sure, it's not been ever made into numbers, but it has been incurred. What sort of work is SIA doing on that? So is it, I know sort of think tanks that, so you guys are, I assume, developing policy or what's the approach?
Yes. So this is a topic that I can get very vocal about. So there is a proposal that is coming to COP30, which has been developed by the Global Solidarity Levies Task Force. And it does exactly what you are saying about the fossil fuel companies having a responsibility. So the idea of solidarity levies is that there are a range of about 16 different proposed taxes that countries could levy. And these taxes are aiming at, you know, taxing the most fossil fuel heavy industries and sectors, and also the companies that you know are polluting. So some of those types of taxes are aviation levies, jet fuel. There is amongst those taxes tax on high net wealth individuals, and a range of options that countries within their own tax system could implement. And there's a group of countries that are part of a coalition of the willing that are eager to try out some of these taxes.
Yeah.
Yeah. Now, I think it will come down to political will. So, you know, it's kind of hard to tax high net wealth individuals. So some of those tax proposals are, you know, kind of like more palatable or ready than others. But I think it's a really good group of tax proposals, and it actually addresses the core problem that we're facing here. So it says, you know, who should be responsible for paying for this? And here are some mechanisms to recoup that money.
And I imagine you already have some reports out that detail this, and maybe we can get this from your description of this video.
Yeah, absolutely. We've got a policy brief on this with recommendations, and we call for countries to join the coalition of the willing and to make use of these taxes to generate domestic revenue that they can use for climate actions as well as development.
And how that money goes internationally.
Yeah.
So I imagine what you talked to as well, about where they went and closed their steelworks, but then they couldn't import the same quantities of steel from China. So they were less emitting, but not really, because they were more filling energy at the sort, at the production, not at the consumption level. So do you also talk about like production versus consumption where emissions are created?
This is such an interesting idea. So in that particular policy brief, no, we don't go into the production and consumption. But recently, we've been holding policy innovation labs.
Yeah.
And some of the participants, particularly a researcher from Russia, was raising the idea that we've become good at looking at the production side within countries, like you're saying. But the consumption side, we don't really focus on, and we need to shift our focus towards that so that we can go, oh, well, the UK is now importing the steel. So shifting our focus to include consumption would actually pick that up.
Yeah.
I think it is an important policy distinction that we need to, you know, advance.
And I think particularly when it's by choice, right? So I think one of the things that's that I think has been very talked about by activists in the climate sector is it's not helpful to blame people who have no choice.
Yeah.
So
yeah.
If you're a low-income individual, you can't actually choose more environmentally. You can't afford. You need to feed your family, you need to feed yourself, you need to keep yourself safe, and you can't afford to pay 20% extra for packaging, which doesn't produce much fossil energy. But I suppose what we're talking about here is, you know, big profitable companies that save 1% by increasing their emissions dramatically. It's really actually very destructive, and it's in a sense it's a theft, right? Because the damage from these emissions are being pushed out to the public, but they've privatized all the gains from those emissions. I'm excited to see where sort of this conversation goes.
Yeah, so if I can pick up on that, there is a kind of idea that focusing in the climate actions on an individual citizen level is actually sometimes a form of gaslighting because, you know, our system is set up in a way that it's using a lot of plastics and so on. So when you go and you buy your groceries, that packaging is there. It's really hard to refuse it, you know. So we need this kind of reform that is more at a systems level that asks the companies that are using the packaging to go for a more sustainable packaging type.
I think what I really thought you're saying there is that I think one of the things, when I think of climate crisis as a silo issue, but actually it's a result of our inequality globally. It's a result of our economic system. It's the way we've designed, the way we have to interact with each other, the way the way businesses interact with each other, the way low-income individuals have to interact with high-income individuals. So it's actually, I think of climate as actually, it's quite an issue of inequality. It's quite an issue which is the consequence of something. It's rather than it being the cause. So sure, it causes floods, it causes these things. But at the end of the day, it's inequality, poverty, unchecked burdening upon the public of private profits. It's that, right?
Yes. And for us in South Africa, as you know, you'll well know as a listener, we have the highest inequality level, and our poverty and unemployment are part of our triple challenges. So these burdens are particularly heavy for us to grapple with as a country. And then I want to come to something that you were mentioning earlier is the inequalities between countries and what that means on a level of national debt and so on. So one of the things that South Africa, for its year as the president of the G20, has put as its priority is dealing with the issue of debt. And there's a kind of unequal relation towards debt where the credit rating agencies see particularly African countries as high risk, and that affects the interest rates that we pay on loans. So there's a kind of percentage of around 6-7% that we might be paying on international debt versus more wealthy countries that are paying such a lower rate for finance. So yeah, they get the loans at like maybe 2-3%, or as you're saying, 0.5%. So that is another kind of form of inequality that one has to grapple with.
What that touches on is historical problems and present day problems. That this is actually this debt issue is ongoing. So one part of the fight is, well, let's stop doing that. Because I think the whole, also let's talk about risk for a second.
Yeah.
Risk is built on the idea that a country can go bankrupt and will never honor its debts. That's not common. All these countries with these high, like South Africa has never not done it. It has, I don't think there are very many scenarios in which South Africa won't honor its debt. And in other countries, when they have failed to honor their debt, you've had literal other sovereign nations go in and challenge their sovereignty. You know, go in and literally kind of force them to sell companies or whatever and do various things. A lot of sort of neo-colonial behavior and the way some European powers still interact with African nations, the way the USA interacts with South African. So if we were to think like a practical change we could do today, it's not the whole story, but it's to actually say this credit rating agency is not all based in the global north, but actually the economic crashes 10, 15 years ago all indicated that their methodologies were also deeply problematic, right? Like banks that went bankrupt in 2010 had better credit ratings than literal countries that have not ever gone bankrupt, ever.
Totally. What I was really quite excited to hear at the Finance in Common Summit is listening to some of the representatives of the credit rating agencies. And there was the, you know, big three that were in the room. And they were saying that they are looking at their methodologies and wanting to see how they can adapt them so that they are more conducive towards developing countries' ratings not being perceived as such high risk. And part of the dynamic that the credit rating agencies have is that they don't have the required data. So they'll have a lot of data that they can get on firms or public entities that are in one country, but then another country they can not find what they need. And so their ratings are more subjective, and that tends to lead to a worse credit rating. And there are some initiatives underway for banks to share data with the credit rating agencies. So that's going to contribute to a better system. But there's also another proposal which is very useful for us in Africa, is an African credit rating agency. And I think that's quite a good recognition that it can't be just the Global North's agencies rating, Africa. Yeah. So it starts to balance out this issue that we have in the global financial architecture and how it works.
So what I'm hearing as well is like there's these strategies, and this is actually when people are, but why do we do these financial stuff? Well, this is the point, right? This is where think tanks, advocacy organizations actually argue with decision makers and convince them to change their minds on stuff. And it's a bit of an exhausting, expensive process, but it is actually even how we make change. But what I wanted to get at in terms of what we're talking about here is there's often a variety of strategies that we make, right? It's some which are like, okay, in our current system, as broken as it is, this is how we can change things a little bit to improve things, while at the same time, we're also arguing for fundamental shift. So we're asking for the current system to change, to be a little bit better, while also staying in this other space, let's fight a revolution over this. And I think this is also where it's really important that we have organizations like SIO, which are engaging in a very insider process. Like the T20 is an insider thing. It's you're connecting with politicians, you're connecting with decision makers globally. But at the same time, there are other really powerful organizations. I'm thinking of African Climate Alliance, I'm thinking of Climate Justice Coalition, Climate Justice Charter Movement is all three South African examples, or three examples that are very large in South Africa. And there's many more. Please don't be offended if I didn't mention you. They're doing really good work, and it's a lot more radical than, say, the work SIO is doing. But it helps, it all sort of works in the same thing. SIO's work doesn't undermine them, and their work don't undermine SIO. It's sort of a collaborative thing. So when activists are thinking of getting involved, I would really encourage them to be, yes, and it's okay, cool. So I'm an academic, this is a really good track for me to participate in, but how do I connect with other organizations? Suppose the question is, how does SIO connect with organizations which maybe push more radical positions and that sort of work?
Yeah.
For the more sort of demanding changes, which are quite probably a lot more work to get done, but ultimately we want to get done.
The first thing that I want to observe is that the idea of not about us without us is something that is on my mind a lot as we sit at the table of the G20. And So I don't think one should underestimate the amazing opportunity that South Africa has in hosting the G20. So it's been a Global South run. Brazil hosted before us, and I think it was India before that. Yeah. And so we've had this moment to speak into the multilateral discussion and to shape it. Because when you're the president, you set the priorities and so on.
Yeah.
And so
the roadshows happen here, right?
So exactly.
International policymakers talk to Africans all over the country.
Yes. And even in the engagements of civil society, every country that hosts the G20 typically finds that the engagement track of the civil society, the C20, has more engagement from local activists. So it is the year to engage with the G20 while it's in South Africa. Obviously, and when it moves to the next country, you can still engage. That's going to be a little difficult of a dynamic because the next...
Yeah.
So just to come back to what you were saying about the kind of insider activism versus outsider, more radical activism, I do agree that both are very, very relevant and that we have this opportunity now to shape the narratives around development, what are the priorities and that kind of thing. And while it's in our country, we must take that opportunity. It is hard to figure out how do you influence and, you know, kind of reach out to connect to the working groups. So what I can mention about how the G20 works is that it has these two main tracks, which are a finance track and then an international relations Sherpa track. And so the finance ministers were the initial kind of focus of the G20 because it emerged as a response, to global financial issues. And so you still have that finance track that's very much the focus. And then you have the international engagements with the international relations officials where they figuring out, you know, what do the countries agree to. And aside from that, the G20 has engagement groups.
Yeah.
So we have a Think 20, we have a Civil 20,
there's 14 of them, don't worry.
Yeah, I kind of go through all of them. But yeah, I think there's opportunities to engage in those groups. And, you know, we've had various organizations attending the Think 20 midterm conference. And so we are engaging in the space with other organizations. And yeah, I do believe as an activist, that there is a need for the outsider activism as well, because multilateral spaces are slow.
Yes.
And they don't always feel the urgency that people who are faced with the actual disasters and the flooding have to address these issues. So we have to urge that as well.
Yeah. I think there's an interesting point there as well to me about why? Why multilateral? Why does it actually matter? And I think it really gets back to that thing you were talking about earlier. It's like taxes on the wealthy are hard. Like, we're in one of the most unequal eras ever of humanity at the moment. And that wealth is consolidated in a few people. But the problem is, if a single country tries to do something about it, that wealth can fly. It will just go somewhere else. So it requires multilateral responses. We were talking about how we tax or bill people for their carbon emissions. If a country decides to go against that, and particularly a big, powerful country, I'm thinking of China, your conglomeration like the European Union or the USA, if they decide to not comply or not collaborate, it undermines these systems, which is actually why we need to have a multilateral. Even though it's infuriating, it's exhausting, and I think it's hard sometimes for someone to go, but hang on, I'm just person living in a rural Mpumalanga environment, you know, my husband or my wife works in the coal industry, my partner works in the coal industry. How can anything I do make a difference? But that's a whole other conversation, but that's actually why we need to participate and why G20 is an opportunity, right? I don't know if you want to speak to that a bit.
Oh, where to start? So on tax evasion, for example, if you don't have a kind of agreement between all countries that they're going to combat tax evasion, you'll have countries that shelter people who, put their money offshore. Exactly. So we do need these multilateral agreements by which we agree across the board that we're not going to allow that. And that's particularly one of the sticking points that, you know, the countries that have been marred with high secrecy levels because they are, you know, aiding tax evasion, don't want to give that up.
They're making a lot of money off it, right?
Yeah.
Broadly speaking, the whole world suffers, but a bit like we were talking about, like, it's the privatizing profit while public losses for everyone else. Kind of what they do on a national level.
Yes. So that's one of the tax reforms that we really need. And that one is sitting at the UN. And then other of the tax reforms would entail agreeing common tax rates. So there's a kind of like a race to the bottom because companies will say, we're going to withdraw our presence in your country if you increase your company income tax levels.
Yes.
And then it's kind of like all the countries are like, this one is sitting at that level. We're going to look there. And it's a race to the bottom. So having a tax reform that would say, no, this is the minimum level.
Unionization.
Yeah. So these are the kind of things on a tax level that are, you know, under discussion. And I think that way multilateralism can be positive.
Yeah.
There are ways in which we have to acknowledge that multilateralism is a bit broken.
Oh.
Yeah.
I think those things we're talking about with like the different tax rates, we look at the way France controls finances of so many West African and South African countries, you know, that's multilateral, messed up.
Yeah. And then I want to come to the level that you're talking about of the person sitting in Mpumalanga.
Yeah.
So I don't want to shy away from that. I had the opportunity to go and do research work in Mpumalanga, and it was really interesting because these are real people's lives. And the idea of a just transition can't be hollow words. So there will be job losses, and we have to reckon with that. And that needs to be done in a way that is, you know, intentional and timed correctly. Yeah.
And I think, you know, we often go job loss equal bad, right? And I think there's other ways to go. So one is that we can create more jobs than we lose, right? So fine, we lose one coal mining job and then we gain two jobs in another sector that maybe pay better or whatever the story is. But I think this is also where, this is actually where when you talk about being involved, because there's this big multilateral moment, you're going to have leaders from the entire world in South Africa in November. If a lot of society gets together and says things very loudly, they're going to hear it. And it's also going to empower people acting on behalf of the global south to say, look, we can't do what you want in the global because look what our people are saying. Our governments will be overthrown if we don't do something about this. So there's that level, right? That actually, that's what showing up to protest does, is that it makes it very clear. It's a moment for powerful people to hear what people that don't have power in this collective have to say. The other part is, we're talking about just transition, I think, is there's often this talk about, oh no, there's these 30,000 something, 40,000 something jobs in the coal mining sector that will be lost. Oh, why? Just give them an attention. Right? You know, these guys have already worked very hard. It's a very, very difficult job. We're spending billions, if not billions, already on schemes to help retrain them to be other things, but why? We can just literally just give them, like, tax the harm of climate change, and we use some of that money to give people early retirement. You won't have people pushing back. They won't say, oh, no, I need another job instead of actually still getting my full salary for the rest of my life. And it probably will create jobs because those people will be able to go and pursue, use their skills and pursue their own desires and likes. And this is, so it's not just about job losses. It's actually more about people's livelihoods, people's dignity. And instead of us focusing on, well, we'll lose a coal mining job, well, I don't think a coal miner cares if they have something else. Like, if they have revenue from something else, if they have an opportunity to pursue a different career that they want to pursue, not one that we say. Like, when people go and say, oh, well, we should turn coal miners into coders, software developers. I think they really want to be software developers. At least the ones I've spoken to are like, I'm not interested.
Yikes.
And I know that's not climate. Like, it is kind of finance in terms of resourcing, but there's this also work that SIA looks at and how the just transition, I suppose it's what needs to be financed by the just transition.
Yeah, so I am very interested in policy proposals that entail financial instruments. So like you just spoke about, that would be a decision that, you know, a country's government could engage in looking at. So, yes, I am embarking on a process of looking at how does the finance get to the door of the people that actually are affected.
Yeah.
And it's been really interesting engaging with the Presidential Climate Commission, because they are thinking about these things in the design of their instruments and their advice. And there's also the Just Energy Transition Project Management Unit.
Yes.
And, you know, they are really taking to heart the just part of the just transition. And it is a kind of like, policy can seem distant and, you know, up at an elite sort of level.
Yeah.
But when it's done with an intent to actually engage with what it means in society, you can make good policy recommendations. So I enjoy that part. Sure. Yeah, and the activism.
You know, force policymakers to change their minds, because I think something we forget is that millions and millions flow in the other direction, where big corporations are trying to convince, threaten, scare policymakers into make decisions in their favor. But we kind of need to organize and respond, much like kind of the union model, I suppose. That said, we're kind of running low on time. And there was really one thing I was going to talk with was the T20, Think 20, right? It's T20 process, goes back away. What should general South Africans that are maybe listening to this, how can they participate? Is there an opportunity for them to participate? What is the T20 to them? What would you want them to know about T20 coming out of listening to this podcast?
Yeah, so I think that, like I was saying earlier, the opportunity for the Global South to speak into the multilateral space is just an opportunity that we shouldn't take for granted. There's an idea that the G20 is a talk shop. And yes, there's ways in which you can critique it for being that. But we actually have an opportunity to provide thought leadership into the space. And so as think tanks in the Global South and in Africa, it's quite an important moment to shape the discourse.
Yeah.
And so that really excites me. Also in the G20, the AU joined at late 2023. And this being the South African presidency is the opportunity for Africa to come into the process quite robustly and engage with what do the G20 outcomes mean for Africa. Coming back to how can you engage with the T20, we are keeping our website up to date. You can look at the policy briefs. There have been amazing policy briefs on all these type of issues that we're talking about that are the priorities that South Africa set. Just energy transition is part of it. And there's quite a nice melting pot of ideas there. So have a look there. See what you want to advocate for. There have been open sort of letters or like petitions to the Sherpa to consider certain things in the leaders' declaration, and different organizations signing on to those. So that's one way to engage with the process. Mm-hmm. And
your support effectively if you're part of an organization.
Yeah, figure out what are the proposals that are coming to the table that make sense for us and get behind them.
maybe just be loud, right? Like, you can talk, you can go on there on the T20 website, see the organizations participating, see if there's a way you can interact with one of those organizations. Not the most accessible, unfortunately, for general public. It is very academic heavy.
Yeah.
Think tank. But there are ways that those organizations on an ongoing basis do talk to the public and they talk to people. And then the intent, if I understand correctly, is you said, you know, the thing about, what is it?
Not about us, without us.
That is an ideology most think tanks and most progressive organizations have. Sometimes they struggle to live up to it. So if there are ways you want to engage with these organizations, you can reach out, which I think leads us to what we can finish off with, which is, so I think we'll link below in the description your website, Asaya, some of your social media handles. Are there any other ways people should get in contact with yourself, with Asaya, with T20 that you'd want to just leave the audience with?
Yes, I always enjoy being invited to present at activist workshops. I come from being an activist. I was just previously working at Corruption Watch and very much still a member of the Budget Justice Coalition. So these spaces excite me and invigorate the way I'm thinking about this work. So I definitely am keen to engage with activists. And my email address is pretty accessible on the SIA website. Yeah, you're welcome. Have a look at our website. We're very actively communicating about the G20 and our work in the T20.
Yeah.
Have a look there, see what resonates and get in touch.
Thank you so much for joining us today, Kirsten.
No, my pleasure.
And yeah, thank you for joining us, and we'll chat soon, I'm sure.
Excellent. All power to the activists.
Thanks for watching this Mobilize podcast. Remember to follow, subscribe, like, and comment.